Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Steve Greenfield, and Steve is going to talk about the collapse of the two major parties. When I talk about collapse, I mean that as far as the Republicans are concerned, a lot of them are still backing Trump, even though he's a lame duck. And there's a schism in the Democratic Party. So, Steve, take your pick. You want to talk about the Democrats or the Republicans first?
Well, I'd like to talk about the Republicans first, but only because of a major headline that's happening right now, which is about this preposterous lawsuit that 17 states, all Republican majority states, are attempting to bring to the Supreme Court to overthrow the election results in four other states that are not among those 17. They're trying to overturn results in four other states, including states that are headed by Republicans, like Georgia is, for example, one of the states that's on their list that they're trying to overturn. So let's talk about, and also 106 Republicans in the House of Representatives, which is out of a total of only 196 Republicans in the House of Representatives altogether, which means 106 Republicans in the House are supporting this lawsuit, and only 90 are not. There are more, it's close to split, but there are actually more, 16 more supporting the lawsuit than did not join in with their names, a friend of the court in the lawsuit. So let's, that's right out there in a big headline over the last couple of days for everyone to see. So let's start out by talking about them. Let's start out by talking about the Republicans and just what the heck this might all be about. So it's a new situation that we're in, right? Both major parties have always been coalitions of people that don't agree with each other on everything, but sort of voluntarily agree to vote together so as to be able to maximize the amount of the things that they do agree on that can actually get done. Right. That's why we have two major parties, and that's why both have a range of ideologies contained within them, and they work together. On the other hand, this idea that the two parties that we have are the only two parties that we can have is historically not a valid assumption. The fact that we have winner-take-all elections, so that you need to get, 50% plus one to live, to win. And if you have 50% minus one, you lose, as opposed to parliamentary systems, right, where people can get elected, they have multi-party elections, and then people agree from different parties to vote together on who's the head of state and then some specific issues as they come up before the legislature. But in our system, we have 50% plus one, or if there's more than two candidates, whoever has the slight plurality, right, a one-vote plurality is the winner. So, yes, that kind of election system tends to create a need for two major parties in order for anyone to be victorious in that kind of election, right, because you need to bring to bear resources to make sure that you're getting more than half the vote. But that doesn't mean that any two parties that happen to exist at any given moment are the two parties that are going to continue to exist. We have many examples throughout our history of a party ending and being replaced by another party. The most conspicuous, of course, is that we have Republicans. Up to the Civil War, we had Democrats and Whigs, not Democrats and Republicans. The Whigs had to split in 1854 because they disagreed with each other about the Kansas-Nebraska Act that determined how far slavery was being extended into unincorporated territories and incorporated territories that had not yet become states as the country moved westward. And so slavery as a galvanizing issue caused the Whigs to split. The pro-slavery ones joined the Democrats, and the anti-slavery ones joined a brand new party called the Republicans. the Federalists won, the first of our two first parties, you know, the other one being the Democratic Republicans that we now call the Democrats, Thomas Jefferson's party. The Federalists were the party of Alexander Hamilton and John Adams. That party disappeared pretty swiftly after 1800, after electing many people throughout. You know, so there's no law that says that changes in current events and changes in public thought about the implications of current events and the direction of the country can't cause one or both major parties to stop being in existence and be replaced by a different one. So that's the first thing we have to understand, that the inevitability of a two-party system under our Constitution does not mean that any two specific parties are inevitable or permanent. So we've seen all kinds of splits and shifts. There have been minor parties that have risen to become very big, and then ended up losing their momentum because one of the two existing major parties got smart and adopted a dramatic part of their platform, specifically to prevent themselves from disappearing the way the Whigs did. So instead of dividing over an issue, a major party might decide to incorporate a bunch of new issues and thereby solve the division problem and remain in existence, right? We saw that in 1932. When the Democrats absorbed a tremendous amount of the Socialist Party's agenda in the perfect storm of the Great Depression, when people were in such desperate need of financial assistance and labor rights, that basically saved the Democratic Party and prevented the Socialist Party from continuing to rise in power and influence. But of course, their agenda continued to rise in power and influence because one of the existing major parties adopted a substantial amount of it and then legislated it into actual existence. So that's the real history of the two-party system. And what we're seeing right now in both parties is that they are experiencing, earthquakes internally within their coalitions over those exact same kind of splits that we saw in the Civil War and in the Great Depression over critical issues that neither major party seems to be developing an effective platform for that would allow them to remain together. One pretty big difference between right now and those earlier instances is that the two major parties that are in power have created systems in election law in all 50 states that have prevented any minor party from rising in a significant enough way that could potentially replace a major party. You know, when Teddy Roosevelt created the Bull Moose Party, the Progressive Party, when he wanted to run again after he'd already stopped being president, he was able to get 15% of the vote. He was able to, Ross Perot got 18% of the vote. A lot of minor party candidates in the past have really gotten, there was the Farm Labor Party, the Fighting Bob La Follette. There have always been parties that have managed to grow before their message was co-opted and then they would fade. We actually have ballot access problems right now that the two major parties legislated that prevent the usual safety valve of people being able to bail out to a rising minor party. That doesn't exist right now, right? You and I have talked about that many times in the past, that there's currently no place to go. So the earthquakes happening right now are pretty significant because they don't seem to have internal solutions in either party. So let's start with those Republicans and what is happening right now. The central issue right now is that Donald Trump has lost this election, and he's lost the election by quite a lot, and he's lost it in the traditional popular vote mechanism as well as the Electoral College mechanism. Because Joe Biden won more electoral college votes in enough states that he has a pretty clear, majority in that. And so what's happening is that Republicans have picked four states, including one solidly Republican state, and announced without any evidence to back it that there was so much voter fraud in those four states. They just happened to be four states with enough electoral votes that if they had their electoral votes taken away from them, that the election decision would go to the House of Representatives, and if that happened, the House of Representatives would choose Trump as president, because despite having a majority of Democrats on the voting floor, the House of Representatives chooses a president by state, not by a straight open floor majority vote, and there are 30 red states and 20 blue states, and so that would keep Trump in the presidency if they were to achieve their goal. Now, of course, without any evidence to back what their claims are, you find yourself having to wonder, why would 17 of the 30 red states, again, more than half of them, take part in this kind of lawsuit, and 106 members of the House, more than half the total caucus, take part in this suit? This shows a pretty clear dividing line over a giant issue, right? Over a giant issue, which is to whether to suspend the elections of the United States for a president and have the decision made in the House of Representatives rather than by the voters. This is really as big of an issue as ever divided a group of people. This is not some niche issue. This is the actual practice of voting for our public officials that they're trying to interrupt, and they're split on it.
Let me ask you this question. Do you think that Trump is being advised to do this? Or do you think he realizes this on his own?
Okay, first of all, Trump is driven exclusively by ego. Trump is pathological. Trump is not an ordinary egotist, right? Trump is somebody with some pretty substantial developmental issues that we, for some reason, still don't have the courage to discuss in a formal way at the level of mainstream media and at the level of competitive mainstream politics. And I really don't know why, because that to me is a much greater threat to the continuance of democracy in this country and the safety of the world and the American people than whether we're kind of inching our way towards fascism. It's one problem to elect people that are sort of anti-civil liberties, and another thing altogether to elect people that are insane. And to keep calling somebody who's insane somebody who's anti-civil liberties is a significant error in our public discourse, because, you know, let's say we put a stop to this. Let's say we put a stop to the rise of people who are anti-civil liberties. Let's say we manage to actually persuade the majority of the American population that putting civil liberties first and opposing fascism is an important component of the American way of life, and we get that accomplished. But then we just elect another insane person. What good was that conversation? We have to call the problem by its actual name, and we're still not doing that. So Trump is somebody of a 4-year-old's ego, of a pathological nature, who views the good of the whole world as being indistinguishable from the good of himself, whatever makes himself feel the most personally rewarded. Or an alternate way of saying that is that he thinks that the good of the world doesn't matter. Like, he personally can't dissociate what might be the case with everyone else in the entire world and the world itself and its ecosystem from his own ego gratification, from his own reward of hitting the reward button and feeling the personal reward. And we're still not having that conversation. And so what's happening in the Republican Party is, you'd have to assume that everybody understands this, right? Everybody who's ever tried to work with Donald Trump, whether in the corporate world or in his presidential administration, comes away with the exact same story. The guy can't seem to put a thought together. He's ranting and raving all the time. You never know when he's going to be happy with you and when he's going to be, freaking out and screaming at you and firing you. Nobody can try to put together any kind of agenda, any kind of organizing principles by which to accomplish a goal. That's the nature of Donald Trump. And so I'm sure that even the people that are supporting this lawsuit are aware of that. And what has to be underlying what they're doing is their own ambitions, you know, what they perceive the people in their own states of expecting from them in order to continue to get their votes when they run next time. People like Ted Cruz, who are still positioning themselves for, you know, the 2024 Republican primary. You know, people are staging, they're staging their future ambitions right now, right? That's what they're doing. You know, there's no grounds for the Supreme Court to take this case because the Constitution is absolutely unambiguous that how to arrange voting, how to count votes, how to select electors for the Electoral College is exclusively the domain of the states. There's no federal role in that whatsoever. If the state were to decide that they want their state legislature to elect all their electors, they're allowed to do that without holding a vote at all. You know, that's what the Constitution says. So no matter how many people Trump appointed to the Supreme Court, there's no way that this is going to be accepted as a case that can be brought before the Supreme Court. You know, that's if that were to happen, there are 17 states on this. You know, the other 33 states would immediately file a countersuit to inhibit the progress of this case because the constitutional question is there's no ambiguity in this whatsoever. There's no federal role in a particular question at hand. And so what they're seeking is they're seeking for the Supreme Court to assume unto itself the role of suspending elections in the United States, of seizing power in the United States. And that is not going to happen. So let's all be clear. If everyone's worried about what happens if the Supreme Court takes this case, please stop worrying about that. That's not going to happen. This is entirely about how people in the Republican Party are viewing their own future as people who need to get votes from Republican voters. And that's where we come again to the significance of the split in the party. We're seeing a split down the middle with just a little bit more than half being on the we need Trump voter sides. What this comes down to, I'm gonna say this in terms that Democrats can understand. This is they're doing a red no matter who kind of thing. They found out in 2016 and again in 2020 that even Republicans that don't like Trump will vote for Trump to avoid having Democrats take over the country, you know, and then they'll just figure, okay, we'll get through this. And a lot of good Republican things will get adopted because Republicans will win seats in Congress as well. And so even though I don't like Trump, it's still better than the alternative, right? And the Democrats have the same mechanism in place, right? Okay, fine, you don't like Biden, but if we don't all vote for him, then Trump's going to win and Republicans are going to continue to control Congress. And we can't have that happen. So let's do this now, and then we'll get back to this other argument we're having later, right? So these Republicans are living in that exact same climate. This is their version of that. They're trying to figure out what they need to do to get elected the next time they run for whatever office they're going to be seeking. You know, and which side of this they wanted to be on. When they run against, when those 106 congressmen run, they're going to call the 90 that aren't part of the lawsuit, they're going to call them rhinos, you know, as a way of trying to galvanize the public and win their next election. So that's what this is all about. But let's get to the heart of the matter itself about what's actually happening with this lawsuit and who are the states that are in it, because we need to understand something about the United States that we, again, like Trump's insanity, that we're always looking away from, which is the original division around this country was built, which was the division over the slave states and the slave economy versus the non-slave states and the, you know, emerging capitalist and capitalist finance-oriented economy of the North when the country was founded in the Constitution in 1789. I'm going to read you a list of the states that are on this lawsuit. Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Kansas, Indiana, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and West Virginia. Okay, so let's go through the state. Let's break that down. Among those states that I just read.
Before you do that, I got a question for you. And this is,
sure.
I think it's really an important one. Now, you're saying that the Constitution was made made up exactly as you're saying it is. In that case, do you think the Constitution was created for the American experience to ultimately fail?
Yes, it's been failing since we created it. Look, we created basically two separate countries, right? One half the country, the states didn't want to join unless they were given certain assurances that their preferred way of operating would continue, and the people in the north were willing to make that concession because they thought the most important thing was to have a fully united country and not whether it would run properly, and many of them actually had what they thought in their time to be a good reason for that. They had just fought against a global superpower for their independence, and it was basically a war of attrition, right? We didn't win militarily over Britain. We just wore them out because they were 3,000 miles away and couldn't afford to keep supplying this war. It was like us with Vietnam, you know. They just backed away. The people in the North understood that if the South were an independent country, that if we formed two countries instead of one, that we would not necessarily have the factories of the North getting the cotton from the South to make textiles, that it would be sold on an open market, and that Britain would be wanting to get it as they always had been up until that point, that would possibly create an alliance between Britain and the South that could, imagine if the South had been on the side of Britain during the War of 1812, the United States would have come to an end at that moment. And so that was what the people in the North were concerned about. That's why they bent over backwards to make the South happy. But what they ended up creating was two separate countries with two separate systems and even two separate ways of counting the census for representation in Congress that were sort of grafted around a free trade and a mutual defense pact. That's what the original Constitution was. Two separate countries joining together into a confederation around free trade and mutual defense. And
okay.
The entire history,
let me ask you another question.
The way till the Civil War. It failed every day, and it's still failing.
Okay. The case, then, all of the young men that were killed during the Civil War, they died in vain. That, in other words, that the South should have succeeded, and the North should have allowed that to happen.
Well, there's another way of looking at it. You know, when the Civil War ended, we did go into Reconstruction, and it seemed like the North was trying to force its version of how America should operate on the losing side, which is typically what would happen when a revolution happens inside a country. But in 1876, 11 years after the end of the Civil War, we had a contested election. We had an election, the Rutherford B. Hayes election. We had an election that didn't actually have a clear winner and went into Congress. And essentially what happened is that the only way to break the deadlock, and it was almost a return to the same argument that happened in 1789, it turned out that the only way to break the deadlock was for Congress to negotiate a deal where Hayes would become president in exchange for Congress agreeing to end Reconstruction and allow the White South to take control of its own administration again. So there was an 11-year window in which the people who fought in the Civil War for the North had not died in vain, but it only lasted for 11 years. When we made that deal in the presidential election of 1876, we essentially restored the original Constitution. We restored ourselves to being two separate countries with two separate systems of administration and two separate ideologies that would return to being grafted around a free commerce and a mutual defense pact. We don't really emphasize the election of 1876 and what it meant. That's when Jim Crow started, right? That's when segregation started. That's when black people suddenly couldn't get elected to Congress anymore. That's when they couldn't go to school anymore. That's when they couldn't register to vote anymore, right? Everything just, they did in 1876, we hit a big reset button and set everything back to 1789, and we didn't try to fix that until 1965. You know, when we went into the civil rights era, you know, we let that run from 1876 to 1965. You know, so again, yes, a failed country. We have failed from the gate. Everything Congress was doing from 1790 to 1860 was trying to create compromises over how many new territories to extend slavery into to maintain the balance on the two sides of the Mason-Dixon line. We never operated as a unified country. And then it broke down into the Civil War. And then it broke down into the election of 1876. And then it broke down into after 1965, after the Civil Rights era. We just realigned again because the Republicans ran the Southern strategy and they adopted all the Southern racists left the Democrats and joined the Republicans. And that's when the Republicans basically became the party of what had been the Southern half, the Southern ideology of the original Constitution, the states' rights party, right? They'll even call themselves that. In 1948, the Strom Thurmond campaign, a third party campaign for president, called itself, its official name was the states' rights Democrats. That was always the code word for slavery, states' rights, for state administration and not really being part of the United States system, of wanting to run themselves except for commerce and mutual defense. So the Republicans then, after 1968, became the states' rights party, became the party of the southern half of the original 1789 Constitution. And that's why they call themselves now, they openly call themselves, you know, originalists, right? We're on the same dividing line that we've been on since the day we started. We have not moved an inch away from the original dividing line. And what's happening in the Republican Party now is the most graphic possible exhibit of that. These people, the 60% of the party that's joining with this lawsuit to overturn democracy, are, you know, they're not out yet with their guns like they were in 1860 and 1861, but they are effectively trying to do the exact same thing. They are seeking to have the Supreme Court end the voting process, and, you know, over the same fear that they always had going back to 1789, which was that one day, in the future, that the population of the North could be large enough to vote slavery out of existence, right? That's why the Constitution was written. Yeah.
Steve, when we're going to talk about the Republicans and Democrats, well,
we have to do a part two on this to get to these two splits. We should have known this would happen.
So you have been listening to Steve Greenfield. This is All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. If you like the show, follow us on Twitter. Thank you for listening, and thanks, Steve, for a wonderful conversation. Have a great day.